Hi, Reem.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
I'm well, and you?
I'm pretty good. Let me introduce us. I am Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV, and you are Reem McGreeby. You've been on Blogging Heads before, although I think at that time you were probably in Lebanon and had recently been to Syria. Now you're actually in Libya. And for starters, why don't you tell us what brought you to Libya?
Well, I run an NGO called Shark, and I'm of Libyan and Syrian parents, so our projects at the moment focus on those two countries. The project I'm currently in Benghazi for is related to documentation of human rights abuses. And so that will culminate in a website which will present the 32 stories that we've documented in Tripoli and Benghazi, and a booklet in Arabic only that will be distributed throughout the cities of Libya. The website will be in both English and Arabic, as we believe that discourse on the topic needs to be both internal and external.
Okay. And before long, I want to kind of get your take on how things are going in Libya, how they've been progressing since the intervention a couple of years ago. But for starters, maybe if you could elaborate on your project a little. You're talking, I take it, about human rights abuses under the Gaddafi regime?
Yes, and our first phase focus is purely under the regime before the 2011 revolution. It's partly so that people who didn't have their voices heard for 42 years feel now that they're being heard. It's also to remind Libyans that everybody, all types of people, all cities and citizens of Libya were affected by human rights abuses in different ways, be it imprisonment or torture, imprisonment without trial for over a decade. In one instance, so far the longest prisoner I've seen was 23 years he was in prison without trial. Rape, property with taken away without compensation. There really have been a number of abuses, and we're doing it on a personal level, so that individuals who went through it themselves or are the direct relative of someone who went through it and is now deceased gives us the kind of details that have been missing. Human rights abuses have, of course, been discussed in great length, particularly those that happened during the 2011 revolution, which essentially was a conflict, which is a different type of human rights violations that would have happened, understandably, on both sides. But the 42 years, what led to the revolution, the kind of acts that people were, the resistance over 42 years and the repercussions, haven't been documented, and that's the motivation. Another motivation, particularly for the internal discourse and why we're having a booklet, is that we want to encourage human rights to be on the top of the agenda so they don't continue, because... Well, it's difficult for a nation that has been in the dark for so long to rebuild its law and order and structure. And we're hoping that if Libyans see that all areas of society, men, women, young, old, 42 years ago, very recently, have been affected. So, in fact, our most recent documented story is from the last day of the revolution. I said we weren't covering the revolution in general, but this particular one was very moving, and they weren't involved in the revolution. It was a whole family, five men, kidnapped on the last day by Gaddafi forces. And our very first documented account was in the first week after the 69 coup. So there's a lot to cover.
Okay. And this may be too simple a question, but is it possible to compare the human rights situation, say, in Libya under Gaddafi to say, the notorious situation in Iraq under Saddam Hussein, or in Syria under the, well, either this Assad or the previous Assad? In terms of kind of like badness, I mean, is it possible to say how it compares?
Though I am Libyan and Syrian, I honestly did not realize the extent of the abuses until we started this project and conducted these interviews. The details, understanding the types of people, the range of people in different cities, the demographic of those abused, and the complete lack of any law that governs these abuses. So I wouldn't want to talk about Iraq or Syria without a similar project there. Yes, I know Syria. I've lived in Syria. However, without documenting it, it's all not hearsay, as if it's not true. But so I wouldn't want to compare. One thing that I've always known about Libya in comparison to various other dictatorships is that there absolutely was no rule of law. There wasn't a constitution, and verdicts, even though there wasn't technically a trial, would be handed down by Gaddafi himself, and they would be read out that way. Brother leader has dictated that you will be imprisoned forever. It really didn't matter whether you were in the political opposition or a distant relative, you could be in trouble. I hope that this kind of activity will be done in Syria soon when people feel free enough to talk. I don't know enough about Iraq to say what things were like then, but we've certainly heard stories that are similar to the ones we're documenting.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Before the Libyan Revolution, I don't think I heard much through the American media about human rights problems in Libya. The coverage was more about kind of what a clown Gaddafi was, you know. And maybe that's just because there was nobody who was no movement in favor of invading Libya or something. I mean, maybe it's when you have, you know, when you have people trying to gear you up for war with a country that you start really hearing about the bad things that are going on in there, you know, which had been the case in Iraq for some years before that war. I take it I would be probably surprised and horrified if I heard what kinds of things were going on there.
Yes. Look, it's the nature of international politics. Every country is looking out for itself and its best interests. And at the time, certain foreign countries, their interest was to entertain Gaddafi because they needed something from him and he needed something from them. And so I'm realistic enough to accept that. It is the responsibility of the people in the country to fight for freedom, liberation, at least freedom of speech. And this is what is quite clear now that they were doing for 42 years. But the fear, and you referred to Gaddafi as a clown now, while he certainly looked it most of the time, he was incredibly methodical. He was not, in my opinion at the very least, an insane man on the loose. You don't get to oppress people, a whole nation, for 42 years by being a complete madman. He was methodical. He was cruel. He, as early as the 70s, public hangings in Benghazi, where the bodies would hang for hours and the traffic would be redirected so that anyone wanting to get from A to B in the city would have to pass by that street. Can you imagine the opposition, how that would easily kill an opposition? But still, every few years, another big opposition and another big crackdown. And yes, you wouldn't have heard about that in the international media because it's not in their interest and it's not their responsibility. And the people from the inside were almost locked in.
Now, are there a significant number of Libyans who are now trying to defend his legacy against the kinds of criticisms that will be embodied in the work you're preparing?
I'm not seeing that. I've been looking online. I know up until last year, some months after the revolution was over, there was still some online, what we call propaganda, in favor of Gaddafi. But generally, I'm not seeing a lot of it now. It could partly be in relation to the speech here. There is freedom of speech, certainly. But supporting Gaddafi is just, it's in the past now. It's not a feasible option for anyone. It is not going to bring him back or his regime back. And it's not going to help the country move forward. And so I think everybody, whatever their political opinion, wants the country to move forward, obviously in different directions. People have different views on how it should move forward. Mm-hmm. But no, I'm not seeing a lot of Gaddafi defenders online or in the street anymore.
Mm-hmm. What is kind of the range of consequential debate in the sense, you know, of what kinds of issues have to be hashed out in terms of freedom of the press, freedom of religion. You know, you read stories in the Western press suggesting that in neither case is the freedom as robust as we're used to here. But what's the conversation like in that regard?
Freedom of the press, it's quite free. Its cadre is just simply underdeveloped, so it's getting better. The journalism, the quality of journalism is getting better. But if you imagine a country at a standstill for 42 years, nothing has been developed. Hardly any government, proper government administration and infrastructure. Everything leads up to one point. Then there's a lot to work on administratively, politically, in terms of systems. But freedom of expression, there is a lot of freedom of expression. There are public protests, often newspapers with different opinions being voiced. I think one major issue is reconciliation, and the other is law and order. But if you consider that in Libya, everybody, and I mean everybody, people I did not expect, have arms, at least a handgun, and the crime rate is not high. Of course, there have been some incidences, and unfortunately, they have been international news. You know, murder, rape, kidnapping, they happen in Western cities on a daily basis, but they don't get international headlines. But that's part of the political tool that's being used now. So that is that law and order is certainly something that the government has to build up. I don't see an issue with freedom of expression at the moment. The religious issue, well, Libya has always been a conservative country, so I expect religion will certainly be a strong part of whichever political movement takes power in the long run. But it's being discussed. The Grand Mufti last week said that Libyan women shouldn't marry foreigners. People didn't turn around and say, "Oh, okay." No, they're arguing against it. They're debating it. What ends up happening, whether it becomes concrete into law or not, is another issue, but that there's discourse around it, just like when Abdeljalil started off the liberation speech with "We will bring back polygamy," there was huge uproar, and it was forgotten about and ignored because it was clearly not going to be accepted by the people.
There were some Egyptian Christians arrested for proselytizing, but I gather they were released. I don't know if you caught wind of that, but that, in any event, that's not. If that happened, that isn't the kind of dominant theme when it comes to freedom of religion there?
No, and unfortunately, like you, I read the headlines at the beginning, but you don't hear about the result. And sometimes the result is very much that law and order took over and either released them or held them for questioning or put them on trial. I don't know what happened with that particular case. But there are cases, and unfortunately Benghazi is feeling particularly targeted by this. I'm currently in Benghazi. I did the first round of interviews in Tripoli a few weeks ago. But Benghazi is feeling particularly targeted by this, that incidences are happening here, just as they are happening in Tripoli. But the media attention is drawn more to Benghazi, and not, it seems, in a very fair or positive way. But this, again, this is the thing about Benghazi. They completely accept that these things are happening and that they are crimes, but they're not being addressed that way. The talk of the Katibas, they are overrunning everything. And I read recently one foreign reporter said something about checkpoints throughout the city. No, there are not checkpoints, Katiba checkpoints throughout the city. There is some army presence. It is very limited, and they don't stop you. It's not a checkpoint in that sense of the term. So I feel very comfortable here walking around. Most of the time I'm considered a foreigner, or, you know, at first glance they think I'm a foreigner, so they start saying, "Hello, can I help you?" And it's very sweet, actually. It's a very, very kind city and country in general. The people are very warm and welcoming. But we don't read those reports. But we should remember that during the revolution, most of the journalists wrote wonderful things about the warmth of the people. And now their attention has been drawn to post-conflict problems.
And what is the prevailing attitude toward Americans. I mean, if I went there as an American, would I be warmly received?
Yes. I mean, the simple answer.
Which suggests that the revolution, as it's played out, complete with the intervention, is kind of widely considered to be a good thing there.
Yes, it doesn't mean that people are happy to have had all that bloodshed. They're very aware that without the intervention, they wouldn't have succeeded, they wouldn't have gone very far, that they requested it, that they're happy after 42 years of continued oppression and attempts to overthrow Gaddafi, that this one finally succeeded. And there is quite some hope that with time, and naturally after 42 years of actually not just a standstill, but really a systematic destruction of the country and its people, that 2 years is not enough to judge a country by and the development of a country by. So yes, as an American, you would be welcome here. They're very friendly people. They like foreigners. They like having conversations. This is the most wonderful thing. And actually, to a degree, this is what needs practice. Freedom of speech. If you haven't had it, not in your generation and not in your parents' generation and in some cases grandparents' generation, it's very difficult to know what to do with your voice once you're allowed to have it. So having conversations is a great thing, and hearing from other people is wonderful too. So debate and dialogue is very much welcome, and I hope will continue to be nurtured.
Mm-hmm. Now, in Egypt, after the revolution, the government wound up being more Islamist than at least some Westerners had hoped. And there's, of course, a fear in Syria that a new regime would be more radically Islamist than the Egyptian regime is. How would you characterize the Libyan government on that spectrum? Is it first of all an Islamist government?
Well, Islamists in the region as a whole have had more practice at politics over the past few decades than, let's say, the liberals. And so it's quite natural that they won in Egypt. And also here, they actually won as individuals because they ran as individuals. Most Libyans I've spoken to have told me that they believe Libyans would not have voted for the Brotherhood as a party, but that people went up as individuals meant that there were more Muslim Brotherhood, let's say, type politicians elected than would be expected. However, the current government is still considered to a great degree a transitional one because their main job is to keep the country going but also set up a constitution, which I think to a degree is creating a delay in the development of the country. Some people suggest they should just adopt the 51 constitution for now so that they can actually do a government's job. At the same time, it's not a bad idea to go through the process of constitution. But I don't know what the result will be. I do feel that it won't be rigged, that there will be a democratic process. As I said, the country is quite conservative in any case, and I don't think it would be a problem if socially it remained conservative even within the law. The problem with Egypt, and this is the comparison that I don't think works, Egypt is not just an Islamic state. It is turning into another dictatorship. And I don't think that the Libyans would let that happen.
So you don't think authoritarianism is really a looming prospect there?
No. No, too many loud voices, too many different activists and opinions. So no, I would be surprised. And in no way to belittle the Egyptian revolution. However, in Libya, a lot of blood was shed. And so people are not going to take that lightly.
And is there much explicit debate about the role that Islam should play in the government?
I think people that I've spoken to talk more about politics and political concepts, and perhaps not policy yet, but very much individuals and what they stand for, and oftentimes their background and the history and what they're known for as oppositionists during the 42 years. But I haven't heard much of that dialogue. I'm sure it's going on, but to what degree? As I said, sometimes when the Mufti, for example, will declare his opinion on something, then it will naturally create debate, both in the newspapers and in the public sphere. But I don't think people fear Islam being a part of the politics.
Okay. And are there sizable religious minorities there, sizable non-Muslim populations in Libya that are indigenous to Libya?
No.
So probably it's kind of just taken for granted that at a minimum Islamic values will inform policy. Maybe in that sense there.
To what degree is the point?
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say the issue is to what degree. And I think the debate is there should be law, there should be a referendum perhaps on certain issues, there should be debate, but that there will not be one leader who says, okay, our interpretation of what will be law is based on our interpretation of religion or the Holy Book or Sharia. That I don't think would generally be accepted, purely because it's a bit dictatorial. So I think there's enough civil society activism, women's involvement, that it wouldn't go down that path. Using Egypt as an example, I think basically the Brotherhood was accepted, despite the fact that there being some controversy about the legitimacy of the elections, until Morsi started talking like a dictator and acting like a dictator. And that's what I think would not go down so well in Libya. Not that it's gone down well in Egypt, and there are, of course, protests and riots, and rightly so. The process in Libya is also quite slow at the moment, which is not a bad thing. It allows space and time for debate, and reconciliation will have to be top of the agenda as well.
So it sounds like you're reasonably optimistic about, you know, because there's a lot of kind of dissatisfaction with the way what was called the Arab Spring has played out in a lot of countries, but it sounds like you're almost suggesting that Libya could turn out to be one of the bright spots.
I think that's very unfair to talk about the Arab Spring being disappointing when we're talking about 40-year-old dictatorships being overturned only 2 years ago. So you can't judge a country after 2 years when it's just come out of a 40-year dictatorship. So I think it's unfair to talk about disappointment in Tunisia or Egypt or elsewhere. But yes, I'm certainly quite hopeful from what I've seen in Libya, the people's activism, enthusiasm. Yes, of course there are problems. One's not saying everything's smooth sailing. But I think they're headed in the right direction. But in general, I'm not a fan of this talk about the disappointment of the Arab Spring or the Arab Spring turning into an Arab winter. 2 years, I mean, as a percentage of 40 years of dictatorship, I really think that people both inside these countries and the West have to continue to remember that and be realistic.
Okay. But at any rate, it sounds like you're suggesting that there's the real prospect for something you don't see in Egypt yet, which is a government that is not very authoritarian and maybe might turn out to be Islamist in some sense or another, but could remain democratic and uphold certain values we associate with liberalism.
Yes,
freedom of speech
and so on. Let's remember, since we are talking mostly for a Western audience, let's remember that democracy is letting the people decide. So if the people decide that they want Islamic values in their government, then that's okay. It doesn't matter whether you or I would want to live under them. But if the people decide that that's what they want, it's okay. And then if the people decide, actually, you've gone a bit too far because it's turned into a dictatorship, then that's okay too. I don't see that happening. I think it's a positive thing that things are going slowly in Libya, because when you rush something, mm-hmm. then it's much easier for it to go sour. So they're taking things slowly, but so far they seem to be heading along the right track. Some people berate the government for not being tougher with the Katibas, who have thus far been unwilling to join the army. And they're few at the moment. But they're doing it softly, and that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. It's frustrating. Mm-hmm. You have to have a lot of patience. But that's one example where we're doing things slowly but surely. Hopefully will work out here, and I do believe it will.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Before we go, let me just ask you one question about Syria, because as you said, you are of mixed parentage. You have a Libyan parent and a Syrian parent, and moreover, you've spent a lot of time in Syria. I think for a while you were running an English language newspaper that fell afoul of the regime there, if I'm not mistaken. And I know you've been in Syria since the revolution started, so. I was just wondering what, I'm sure you're keeping track of events there, I was wondering what is your take on how things have been playing out there, what the state of play is there?
I don't think it's going to play out very well. International intervention seems incredibly unlikely. I think all this talk by the West of arming the revolutionaries now is a bit late. Even if it happens now, I mean, if it had happened nearer the beginning, they may well have been stronger. At the moment, it really seems to be a balance of power between the two sides, who neither of which are going to stop. They're going to fight till the death. And unfortunately, most of those deaths are civilians who aren't on either side. That's not to say that they wouldn't like to see the Assad regime over, but after 2 years, 3 years, it's going into the third year. It doesn't look very, very bright, and I actually most of the young people I've spoken to there do believe that a military solution is not possible; that it would have to be a diplomatic one. And so,
really?
I, again, that doesn't seem to be working very well. I think this is what, when we can draw comparisons between Libya and Syria, during the Libyan Revolution, I was involved in the media arm of the Libyan Revolution. And at the time, I was a little, not skeptical, but I wasn't sure what to make of the fact that there were some Gaddafi regime officials in the transitional government. But now I realize the NTC did a really fabulous job in keeping the country united against one goal. Mm-hmm. And once they achieved that goal, they, let's say almost gracefully, handed over power and had elections, and things took their natural democratic course. The problem in Syria I see is that the opposition politically is incredibly weak, if they can even be called to exist so much. Unfortunately, I'm not particularly hopeful in the short term for Syria, though I hate saying that.
I mean, I do. Don't you think that, I mean, eventually the regime will fall, don't you think?
Yes.
I mean,
there's no doubt that this regime will never take control of the country again. That I have mm-hmm. absolutely no doubt of. It's an impossibility. And so you might ask, why are they fighting then? They must realize that too. Either they don't realize that and they really think that they can regain control of the whole country, or some theories are that they're trying to gain control of enough territory that they can mm-hmm. almost split off. I don't actually think that's realistic. They're fighting from Damascus, but the majority of their population, if we want to talk in terms of demographics, is in the north, northwest. I don't see that actually happening. Or they just realize they're in a corner, and so there's nowhere else to play out.
Right. Okay. Well, that's not a cheerful note to end on, but a lot of what you reported from Libya does sound heartening. So thanks for taking the time to inform us.
Thank you, and
good luck with the project, which sounds very worthwhile. I hope you'll come back and see us again.
I hope within a year I'll be talking to you about this, about Syria, and we'll be there and we'll be documenting and things will be rebuilding.
I hope so. I'd love to have that conversation.
Thanks, Bob.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.